My name is Lawrence Allen.
I'm Ronald Shaw.
I'm Rahul Vora.
And this is Bad Time Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Bad Time Radio. And this time we have a full five pack. We've got me, Rahul, Ronald, Brandon, and Dan. A real meeting of the minds on Dan and Brandon, who I don't believe have met each other before. So hopefully, you know, massive chemistry ensues.
Even though they're essentially both co-hosts, somehow.
Yeah, rotating co-hosts who are never allowed to meet. Yeah. And who, because I suspect neither of them really listens to the show, do not know that the other person exists.
I mean, I might not be the most regular listener, but I like to hear myself talk, so.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, co-hosting on a podcast you don't listen to is the most alpha energy you can have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Except for, I mean, while still being on a podcast.
Right.
Anyways. Right. The reason we have them on is that we are discussing an exceptionally rich text, which is the 1989 film Tango and Cash, starring Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell. And the reason we're watching this movie completely out of sequence is last episode I attempted to own Ronald by making him watch The Pope's Exorcist on the logic that if he liked it, then that would prove that I would be like doming him and owning him by showing that I had good taste in movies and like making him subservient to my will. And if he didn't like it, I would have owned him by making him waste some of his time on Earth watching a bad movie. But then Ronald turned the tables by having no strong opinions on it whatsoever. And I had an existential crisis about what it means to like a movie. So I got owned, but I wasn't going to take that lying down. So I'm like, emergency episode, we're watching Tango and Cash. Ronald will love this movie. And then I will have owned him through some logic that I do not care to explain to you guys because I'm not sure it really holds up. But rest assured, he is owned. And
you know what? I like the saga where you own me by recommending movies that I enjoy. You know what?
Yeah,
I'm into this. Let's keep doing this over and over.
I was trying to kind of think of like a movie that you wouldn't like, but the problem is that the only way to being sure you wouldn't like a movie is to pick a movie I wouldn't like. And I don't really want to watch one of those. I think that the list of movies that I really like and you don't, I'm sure they exist, but it's going to be pretty
small.
I'm
pretty sure you like some weird shit, Lawrence, so I'm pretty sure you could find something.
Here's the thing, though. The thing that makes me dislike a movie is mostly that the movie is boring. So if I like a movie, it's kind of almost guaranteed to at least be entertaining, even if it's not good.
You liked 2025, from what I remember.
I did. That movie was really funny.
Ronald did not like it.
That's fair.
You could probably find camp like that, where it's like stuff where you enjoy watching something so terrible that I don't find the humor and the irony.
But that's such a high risk maneuver, because if I miscalculate even a little bit, I'm stuck watching a movie that's 2025.
Yeah, but you know, if you want that big reward, you gotta risk it.
You know what? I respect the idea of just making me watch a movie that I, you know, it's like, hey, it's a fun one.
Yeah. So anyways, let's go around and would you guys recommend this movie? Brandon, what did you think?
Yeah, overall, I think I'd recommend it. I definitely, like, probably the first 5 minutes, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to hate this movie. just like the opening with Sylvester Stallone and then Kurt Russell was like, this is so like hugely dense 80s cheese. I just didn't know if I could take it. But then I think it got better. The ending got a little out of hand, but to say the least. But overall, like, yeah, it was entertaining. So, yeah, I'd recommend it.
I'll go next. Okay, first of all, I recommend this movie. It is an enormously fun time at the motion pictures. I'm also kind of fascinated by it because I can't tell if it's in on the joke of itself or not. There's a lot of stuff in it that really reads like a parody of an 80s action movie. But on the other hand, there's nothing in it that I could point to and say, like, this could not have happened just if you were trying to one-up 80s action movies and happened to do all of that in one movie. But it's still really suspicious that you have all of this silly one-upping shit just in one movie. So I can't decide if this is an early, like, example of the nobody phenomenon where someone makes a parody but they make it kind of with too much skill, so it ends up just looking like a weird version of the thing, or if it's just a weird, like, 80s action movie. So it has that frisson in addition to just being a really funny movie where, like, Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone banter for 100 and, what is it, like 80, 90 minutes, somewhere in there. It's also
pretty short. I think it's like a tight 97 or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the action sequences don't really work, but the two, whatever level it's operating on, the two of them legitimately have incredible chemistry. So it's just fun to watch. Rahul, what do you think?
Well, I recommend it, and I didn't get to the ending.
I knew you wouldn't. Damn it. I wish you'd taken that fucking bet, Ronald. You're a coward, and I could have been $100 richer.
Even if I didn't take the bet, I spiritually lost the bet. I almost took it.
Yeah, Rahul messaged me on Saturday. I messaged him, and I'm like, how are you liking the movie? And he's like, well, I like what I've seen, but I haven't finished it. So then on Wednesday, I'm like, hey, Raul, have you still not finished the movie? And he's like, yeah. Then I'm like, Ronald, I will bet you $100 that he does not finish this movie.
Well, I didn't take it. You know, it doesn't matter. I recommend it. This movie gets my recommend. God, I thought their banter was hilarious. It was kind of hilarious, like, how much... It's like you can't tell if they hate each other or not.
I maintain that at least Sylvester Stallone really wants to fuck Kurt Russell, but can't quite admit that to himself.
Yeah.
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 That's the real reason he doesn't want him dating his sister, because he wants to date him.
You joke, but...
You're joking, but a lot of the scenes in the movie just play like that is what is happening. Anyways, Ronald, what do you think of this?
Oh, dude, this was great. Yeah, I mean, it's objectively a very, very stupid movie. Like, the plot doesn't work as itself, like Lawrence said, but it is like a step away from a parody. It feels like this movie was a parody, and Sly, like, tried to get it to like... actual action movie status. That's how I kind of interpreted what was going on here. And when Lawrence told me that this movie, you know, like the main characters, it can be read as they actually want to have sex with each other. I thought this movie was going to be like really mean-spirited, homophobic, to the point where it's like, oh yeah, they're making so many homophobic jokes that, you know, you can read like a sexuality there. But it's got a straight up like sexual energy to it. It is homoerotic for sure. I don't know if it was like the writers were intentionally doing that or if it just like happened, because that's kind of how buddy cops and rom-coms are kind of the same kind of movie. But there's some lines in this where like Sly's like, hey, I don't think my sister's your type, okay, pal? And it's like, what do you mean by that? I think it actually makes the movie work a little bit better. So I don't know. I had quite a good time with this movie. I was very afraid that it was going to be like super, like really annoyingly homophobic. I didn't find the jokes were really that mean spirited.
For a movie of this period, at least.
Yes, for a movie of the period, and for given how many like homosexuality jokes there were in this.
But it's weird because the homosexuality jokes, it's more like. A bad guy will say, fuck me, or go fuck yourself or something. Or he'll like imply that Stallone's gay, and Stallone will just go, I prefer blondes. So Stallone is doing the, yeah, I'm gay, but you're not my type joke, as opposed to the, no, I'm not gay, or you're actually the gay one because being gay is bad. And they're all jokes it's about like, being gay, but, you know.
Totally. It's like guys joking about it where they're like, they feel like somewhat secure. About their like the joke is coming from a secure place rather than an insecure place, which I don't know. It felt to me less mean spirited. I don't want to say like this is like straight up like an ally movie or anything.
This is a liberatory work of art.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to say too much, but I guarantee that there were at least some, you know, gay fellers just hitting puberty in 1989 who went out to this movie and saw the shower sequence in particular and figured some shit out, you know? That just has to have happened.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, like Brandon said, this is a very dense block of 80s cheese. If that's your thing, like take a bite. This is good stuff.
And finally, Dan, I think you actually come down pretty hard on the is it a parody or not. So you want to walk us through sort of the minds of Dan?
Yeah, I did a little cursory research on this, fellas, and you picked up a lot of what was actually going down. But first, what I want to say is I give this movie my strongest possible recommendation. It is a fascinating work of the perestroika era and late Cold War society. I am not kidding.
Well, there's even a guy who says it was like it's a perestroika.
Yeah, yeah.
He's wearing Gorbachev merchandise, which should not exist.
It's the scene introducing Cash where he has a Kurt Russell, where he has a madcap car chase where he steals a guy's car to run down a perp and crashes a bunch and, you know, totals the car. And the guy comes running out and he's like, "Oh, you stole my car," you know, with his accent. He's wearing a Gorbachev t-shirt. He's like, "I'm here from Perestroika." And of course, Kurt Russell quips, "Oh, yeah, well, welcome to America." You know, yeah. But did you guys know that this film was directed by a Soviet director?
Yeah, it's so fucking nuts. A man who's studied at the feet of Eisenstein and all the other great formalist Soviet masters.
And he's like a legit guy. Surprising. He's like a legit guy. He had movies that were big successes on the international film circuit. Like, he came up through like the Most Film system. He was one of those guys. He was a Soviet film director. And I don't know the details about how he came to where it has to be related, of course, to the policy, the Gorbachev era policies of openness and perestroika. And you have more cultural interchange and more kind of across the Iron Curtain cooperation and cultural interpenetration. So as I understood, I did a little cursory reading. This is literally just the Wikipedia article level. So I didn't even dig all that deep. But this project began life as a parody. It was intended to be a parody. The producer, John Peters, wanted to make a send-up of dense 80s cheese. But he got Stallone on the project. So Stallone and I don't remember the director's name, sadly, but Stallone and the Soviet director wanted to make something played straight. Like, they really wanted to make a thriller. So throughout the entirety of the production, there was this tug of war between the director and Sylvester Stallone and the producer, who wanted to make a goofy send-up, and they wanted to make a straight thriller. And that tension is so baked into the product that it's an incredible document of not only the late Cold War period, but also of the potential of these creative projects in absolute tension. With people going in totally opposite directions. The original director, the Soviet director, was eventually fired. He was booted off the project before it was completed, and they brought in another director to finish it, which mostly ended up being shooting the stunt shots. They hadn't done the stunt driving shots. So my theory is that scene with, you know, like the scene introducing Cash is a stunt driving scene, right? I think the Soviet guy getting his car totaled and whining about Perestroika was a dig at the previous Killjoy director, who was just trying to make an actual really beautifully shot action movie.
Wow. Welcome to America, pal. Wow.
Yes, I don't know. I can't tell you. I haven't read enough. I haven't read the oral history of Tango and Cash to know. That's my gut feeling. And that just makes everything. I'm glad that I learned that after I watched it, though. Because just to have this movie just wash over you and all of it's just this is a movie that's like sitting at the mixing board making the most awesome rock album of all time and pushing all of those sliders up to the red zone. It is pretty remarkable. And also, again, how many times has Jack Palance played a drug lord?
I mean, at least in Batman as well. This apparently has a lot of his Batman performance.
He's in Batman. It was in, he played a drug lord in, he played a drug lord in the Charlie's Angels ripoff film feature on Mystery Science Theater, Angel's Revenge. I remember that had Jack Palance in it. So that's at least three times he played an evil drug lord, and I'm sure a dozen more times since. But strong recommendation. Fascinating backstory on this one. And I'm happy to sort of dive into interesting details with you fellas.
Yeah. Wow. So anyways.
That was beautiful, Dan.
Yeah. I'm glad.
Thank you.
It's always awesome when just someone vibes with something that powerfully.
Yeah, I almost want to send you like five Blu-rays of it, you know?
I was having a great time and also broadening my understanding of Soviet cultural exchange during the late Cold War period. So I couldn't ask for anything more, really.
So I wonder if a lot of this movie could then just be read as a Soviet guy trying to be like, this is what America is like to me.
Yep.
Well, he nailed it.
Yeah, exactly on point.
Tanker also, trucks full of cocaine, naked showering.
People having sex in garages for no apparent reason. No real reason.
You know, it really does beg the question, though, why Sly and the director signed on to a parody movie, and then we're like, let's actually make this just like a straight up, like, not parody. Let's go. It's like, well, you guys read the script, right? Like, you had to have known what you're getting yourselves into.
This is why I would be interested to dive a little deeper. Because, yeah, I'm with you. Like, how do you even, like, get on this project? But, and even now I'm curious what Kurt Russell thought.
I mean, yeah. The main thing we know about what Kurt Russell thought is that Sly keeps trying to get a movie, a sequel to this made, and Kurt Russell keeps saying no.
I don't think it was that well received.
No, it made a fuck ton of money though.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, I asked before I watched it. I was telling my wife what I was doing tonight, and I said, "Well, I'm going to watch a stupid movie, so I can talk about it." And she, you know, rolled her eyes. But I was telling her, "Like, yeah, it's Tango and Cash. You ever seen it?" And she had never seen it, but apparently it was one of her mom's favorites. She remember that her mom would rent it from the video store, and she just thought it was a hoot.
So. You know, I can understand this because it's like it's definitely a movie like I could see if it was on TV, I would totally watch it again. You could jump in basically at any point, like all the different parts of the movie have like really crazy stuff that's like really fun, and like I don't know, just like. There's kind of distinct parts to this movie, and all of them are like kind of insane in their own way, which I kind of enjoyed. Easily rewatchable movie for me.
Yeah, this is the movie you see when you're driving to LA, and there's like this desert gecko inn, and it's got like only CRTs in these tiny little rooms. You turn it on, and it's playing Tango and Cash.
Very specific.
I was gonna say one reason I love talking to you guys is I get such a window into Southwestern lifestyle.
there's someone outside yelling tamales.
Let me tell you this, Dan. Rahul's view of Southwestern lifestyle is not exactly.
Whoa, Rahul, I have longer history here now than you do. All right, so
it's actually very weird because his ideas about Albuquerque and the American Southwest are mostly very offensive stereotypes. But it's very baffling because he's lived here basically his entire life.
You were gone for what, like 2 years?
1 year.
1 year.
One whole year.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I wasn't even gone. LA is the Southwest too, right? Like, sort of.
As far as I'm concerned, it's all the same to me.
Desert.
I mean,
Once you get past the Mason-Dixon line,
it's all the...
far as I'm concerned, from here in Alabama, thank you.
That's one way of approaching American geography.
Look, if you're on the right side of the Civil War and you're below the Mason-Dixon line, you're the Southwest. That's just how it works. Which, oddly...
I will point out, though, Lawrence, that every state in the Confederacy also raised units for the Union Army. There were units from... the Alabama 1st Cavalry was in the Union Army. Mostly everyone was a piece of shit.
Wait. Yeah. That is so weird.
I have no idea if this is true, but my favorite Civil War, well, I've got two favorite Civil War facts. One is that thing that I think the first Minnesotan did at the Battle of Gettysburg, where they were outnumbered like 20-1 and their commander's like, hey, we need to buy some time, go charge that line. And they all just kind of did it knowing that they would die. And I think that's pretty cool because, you know, just...
Yeah, you're obsessed with that.
Yeah, you really
are. Yeah, it rules. But anyways, the other one...
It rules.
Yeah.
Totally, dude.
Die. It rules to die abolishing slavery. You get to abolish slavery, and you get to die.
Well, anyways. Okay. See, now we're getting back into it. I was like, yeah, I'm on your side for a second.
Yeah, but anyways, my other favorite Civil War fact. So I don't know if this is true, but at least on the Wikipedia page for New Mexico and the Civil War, it claims that the main reason we stayed in the Union was that Texas was in the Confederacy and we hated them so much.
Really?
Yeah.
We weren't going to war with the Confederacy. We were going to war with Texas.
Because yes. They keep fucking invading.
I mean, I agree, yes. But we would get totally and utterly crushed in that fight.
I don't know. We whipped their asses at the Battle of Gloria in a pass, and now we're a nuclear power and they're not.
He's smitten, dude.
It's an interesting perspective.
You don't think Texas has nukes deployed to it?
Not as many as we do, bro.
Yeah, I guess so. You only need so many.
Fuck around and find out.
Yeah, we got a bunch of
one, but that doesn't matter.
Cross our border, I dare you.
I mean, Texas is pretty big. I think you might need more than one.
Let's just make a really sure.
I mean, it's in the world, but you know.
Just make sure that the place that you hit is Dallas. I do not like that place.
Anyways, it does. Most fucked vibes of any city I've ever been to. Horrible freeways, too. Anyways, let's talk about Tango and Cash some more. You guys want to roll for the summary?
Yeah.
Should I include Rahul?
No, you shouldn't.
Yeah, definitely don't include Rahul. He didn't even watch it.
It would be pretty funny, though. Okay, I'll leave him out. So it'll be me 1-2, Brandon 3-4, Ronald 5-6, and Dan 7-8. Here we go.
All right.
It's a full. Brandon, you're up.
All right, Brandon.
Okay, right. 1:30 on the clock, and everyone mute. But Brandon, would you like a little more time?
I don't know. That's probably fine.
Give him 2 minutes, and then if he ends early.
If he ends early, he can just invent more things that could have happened to Tango and Cash. Perhaps like they could have gone to the movies.
And then they go to the moon.
Yeah.
Honestly, I could see that happening.
Kurt Russell would only say yes to the fucking sequel, we could find out. Anyways, 3, 2, 1, hit it, Brandon.
Okay, so we open on two narcotics cops who are working on different sides of LA. They don't work together, but they're... We learn that they're both causing trouble for this main head crime boss guy, and he's discussing with his subordinates how to deal with them because they're losing all kinds of money. He decides that they can't just kill them, so they plan to set them up for a murder. So they get both these cops to have a tip on the same drop/drug deal. So they both end up at this place. They walk in, and there's just a dead body and a tape recorder running. They don't know what's going on, but then a bunch of cops burst in. They get arrested. And they ultimately go to jail because the trial is just like a bunch of people testifying against them and they're surprised the whole time. So they also end up getting sent to Gen Pop with a bunch of criminals who obviously hate them because they got put there. They get taken prisoner one night, and these inmates like beat them up and sort of lightly torture them. And this crime boss guy shows up and is like taunting them from the shadows. It ultimately gets broken up by this assistant warden guy who's friends with Cash, and he gives them a plan to escape. But Sylvester Stallone doesn't really trust that. That turns out to also be a trap, but not really of the warden's design, because they end up walking in on him or coming across him dead, where bloodhounds are like closing in on them. They do some other crazy stunts and they do still escape. Outside of prison, they do some asking around. They find out about this crime boss Perrette, and they find out where he is. They get this weird tank-like van from this Q-like figure at Cash's police department, and they just decide to like drive through the gates and go assault this place, which is on an old Air Force base. They have a really crazy car chase scene, but ultimately they get into the main building and they fight some henchmen. They kill Perrette and rescue Sylvester Stallone's rescue Sylvester Stallone's sister. Get out of there before the building self-destructs. And that's basically the end.
Well, you went over a bit, but who gives a shit? That was a great summary, dude. So
that was so much more coherent than the movie.
Yeah. Okay. So anyways, let's get into some high points. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm going to start, which is that there is This is a pretty fast moving movie. Most scenes are like a minute to 2 minutes long, really. There are sequences that'll go longer, like action sequences, but in terms of dialogue, usually 1 to 2 minutes, right? Give or take. You guys buying that?
Yeah.
Which makes it all the more awesome that there's a minute 30 second sequence where Tango and Cash take a shower together and just constantly talk about each other's dicks. Just constantly. And it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's not, I don't even really think that there's that much information shared in that scene.
Yeah, like Cash has a theory about who set them up, but it turns out not to be right.
Yeah, and so I was like, this is a pretty tight movie. There's not that much to it. It's like 90 minutes long. Like, they clearly cut a lot of stuff. They decided that one, they got to keep the shower scene.
Well, the thing is, I think that might be part of the parody element, or like, I think this was considered a very important thing to have in the movie by the powers that be. I'm presuming the producer who wanted to make a jokey movie, because I think part of the joke that he was hoping to make about these movies is making the subtext text, right? Because there's always, you know, you go back, like, you know, even the most, one of the most fascist movies of all time, Conan the Barbarian, is also very homoerotic, the way the camera, you know, lingers, like, this is a movie made by men lingering over the body of a man. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot in these movies. And so I think the reason why the shower scene was so pivotal, why it was allowed to breathe, why it was given that so much space, is because that was kind of one of the central pillar jokes, really. And there's another thing that, like, it's a joke that's not exactly a joke. It's not a punchline so much as a heightened reality but not a heightened reality of reality like these thriller films are, but a heightened reality of the reality of the thriller films. If I'm getting too far up my own ass, let me know. But I think that's what's going on with that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, this is one of those scenes where, like, if you're watching it, you're like, is this a joke? Like, what are they doing here? But the weird part about this movie, and, like, clearly, like, from what you saw from the behind the scenes, there was, like, a push and pull here, but it really keeps trying. It goes back and forth between, like, this is, like, so clearly parody, and then, like, parts where it's like, I don't think it understands that it's parody, or it is trying really hard not to be.
Or and this is one of those scenes where it's, or it'll slip into, like, regular jokey action movie as opposed to a parody of those same things. So, like, there are long sequences that are just, like, an action movie where the main characters make a little bit more wisecracks than normal. And even then, not by that much. Like, I don't think that they really joke wisecrack that much more than, like, Schwarzenegger does in Commando, for instance.
Yeah. Well, I think a scene that's a high point for me that I think speaks to the parody nature is, it's also in the prison, but it's when they are, and however this prison operates, I have no fucking idea, but they're there in the Gen Pop, and they are, of course, you know, beset by this mob of criminals that they have put away, including Robert Zadar everything, like, Samurai Cop? Or Robert Zadar? I don't know.
He's Maniac Cop. He's not Samurai Maniac Cop.
Maniac Cop.
He's in Samurai Cop too, I think.
Okay. Well, that would explain my confusion.
Basically, anytime they're like, we want a heavy who looks weird, but we don't want to pay for makeup, they'd either hire him or Michael Berryman.
Oh, so I was going to say, he's a very Dick Tracy villain looking man.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who got born with a rare congenital disease and decided to make the most of it by becoming a very recognizable character actor.
Yes. But anyway, so our guys are captured by all these, you know, criminals who have set up an elaborate torture chamber with big tubs of water that they have put live wires into, and Tango and Cash are, like, chained, are, like, you know, bound by chains and dangled above these pits, and they take turns being dipped into and electrocuted while the other is shouting in anguish as his friend writhes in torment. And for one thing, I think there's the homoerotic element in there. Like, they're shown, this is one of those times that they're shown to, like, really deeply care about each other's safety and security, and are it's real anguish that they're being hurt and tortured.
And also kind of plays out like a bondage porn a little bit, although that angle is very much so.
with the chains and everything. Yeah. But it's also, this gets shut down by that assistant warden guy who comes in and says, all right, everybody, knock it off. And everyone just goes, yeah, they're just like, oh, okay, jig is up. But it's like, what kind of prison where this can be set up, but there's still enough authority on the part of the guards that everyone agrees to go back to their cells?
And there are so many parts of these movies that make zero sense. Like, why are they even torturing him there? Wouldn't they just want to, like, finish him off so that they
That's too easy. That's them getting off too easy. They got to make him suffer.
There's this fantastic line where Jack Palance has constructed this incredibly elaborate plan to, like, frame them for murder, but then kill them in prison anyways. And he talks to his subordinate, Gul Dukat, and he's like, now do you see why I can't just kill them after they're in prison? And Gul Dukat just looks at him and goes, no, it seems like it would be much easier to kill them.
It's like, I don't, what did this change?
Yeah, they're going to be out. Also, apparently they got 18 months for, like, murdering a guy for drug money and also torturing a bunch of people.
Well, yeah, they had a courtroom scene even. So they got 18 months because they took the plea deal, and they had this big, like, courtroom scene where, like, Tang, you know, sort of illustrating their fire and ice personages. Tango gets up and, you know, he knows he's going to get railroaded. And he just says, like, I just want whatever happens here today does not reflect the fine man on the police force or whatever. And then Cash gets up and is like, I just want to say this is bullshit to hoots and cheers from everyone in the court.
Yeah, it's like, what? Right. Some of you guys testified against him. Right. Why are you cheering now?
I think that Jack Palance scene with Gul Dukat might be the same one. So Jack Palance has two rats that he loves and takes care of. I'm very glad that he didn't.
He keeps kissing.
And also, one of the most amazing details I've ever seen in a film, they're in his lair, his drug lord lair, where he has his desk, and he has, like, a little bar off to the side. And he takes his little rats over there and opens a door and puts them into a rat maze that's built into the bar, like the bar surface. And
to illustrate a point about putting Tango and Cash in a maze.
Right. And I just was so bowled over by that detail, and I love it so much. And next time that I renovate my house, I'm getting a bar installed with a rat maze.
Oh, you have to.
Now I gotta.
I have a question for the group chat, or the group. Do we think he had that made custom for this Tango and Cash discussion, or did he have that already? Either is strange.
I definitely feel like somebody wrote this down, and the props department was like, what the hell do we have to build up this whole set piece for, like, this throwaway line that's stupid anyways?
And then Jack Palance fully commits to it and keeps kissing the rats and talking about how much he loves them. It's incredible.
Yeah. But to be fair, they look like really good rats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like,
that's a moment where, oh, I'm sorry, Brandon, go ahead, man.
I was gonna say, like, when he took them out, like, the whole time I was worried he was gonna do something to them, like hurt them or whatever, because
he's
like implying that that's Tango and Cash. I was like, oh, what's he gonna do? Well, then he goes and he says, we're gonna play a game, and he puts them in the maze. And so then I thought, like, the setup was gonna be something really complicated, but it was like, no, we're just gonna frame them. I was like, okay, that's not really connected to the maze.
We're gonna send them to a nasty prison, and then we're gonna kill them. It's more complicated than shooting them, but it is still only three steps.
I guess it makes them look a little bit worse in the public eye.
I think the idea was to defame them so that no cop would ever. You think getting killed would be. Right.
Yeah. I understand the plan. Too. Like, he wants them off the street so that, like, in 2 weeks, when the next big arms deal goes down, they're not going to interfere. And then over the course of 18 months, they, like, lose credibility, and maybe they also get murdered in prison, and then they can.
At that
point, they don't matter. But yeah, I just didn't understand the connection to the maze.
Yeah. the maze classic. Is the maze of budding awareness of homosexual feeling.
It could just mean that this guy overcomplicates everything.
He definitely overcomplicates his security at his drug depot.
He really wanted to use the rats in this.
I got the rats. You know.
Yeah. Listen, I love these guys. I need to give them some kisses anyways.
Look, if I monologue with the rats, technically the bar is a business expense and I can write it off on my taxes, okay, guys?
Technically, rat food, my number one expense.
I love the idea of like a drug kingpin with a like a secret fucking volcano lair is also very punctilious about his taxes.
You know, this is actually, no, serious, this is an incredible thing I learned. There are drug dealers who pay taxes. It is possible to pay taxes anonymously. And then if you ever get caught by the feds or whatever, you can say like, no, I filed XYZ tax returns on this illicit income. So suddenly that's like a whole class of crimes you didn't commit.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
You'd have to be like such a forward-thinking drug dealer to do that.
I mean, tax crimes are a lot of often how they like really tack on a lot to those dudes' sentences.
Yeah,
but you know, so
that's true. Yeah.
I mean, think about it. You got to get like a underground accountant, and you just got to do so much. You know, like that's crazy.
Just paid in cash, dude.
Yeah. I mean, good luck finding a CPA that'll
just use TurboTax, bro.
you walk up to the IRS and you slide an envelope through full of cash under their door.
It's an anonymous return.
Yeah, they're like, what? We don't do that here.
Anyways, anyone else got high point? Yeah,
high point. We were talking about the court scene earlier. Tango and Cash have a brilliant defense. And that defense is generally anytime one of the witnesses that comes up to testify against them, they talk very audibly about how they're going to kill them when this is all over. It's like, bro, even if you get off of this one, I'm pretty sure you're going to jail now anyways. Like,
for committing massive witness intimidation. But of course, the problem is that everyone in that courtroom loves them and would never testify against them.
That's true. I have a small high point, but one that really encapsulated the 1989-ness of it all. There's a scene where they've busted out of jail to try to find, and they're going to go find Tango's sister, who Cash does not know this is his sister yet. It's just like they're going to go find someone they can trust. So she works as a dancer at a glitzy nightclub, and she has this huge elaborate dance act, which includes her going to town on some gated drums on stage, like those electric drum sets. Like she gets like drumsticks and just like, you know, and I thought that was hilarious. It sounded great. The gated electric drums is just one of those that in a Proustian rush brings back a very specific time span in my life.
I have some things about that scene, actually. So first of all, apparently Terry Hatcher actually learned to play the drums for that. And my question is kind of why, though, because
it was really not a sophisticated beat. Yeah.
That's really weird that was written in and not like Terry Hatcher being like, I got to play the drums in this one because it'd be cool and I know the drums. Like, yeah. They were like, yeah, the dancer goes and hits the drum set, and she's like, I guess I'll learn that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much just like some syncopated eighth notes. Like, it wasn't like the, you know, she wasn't playing Take Five, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But anyways, and then I'm almost positive that sequence started out as a strip club, because none of the dialogue actually makes sense for a glitzy nightclub. In particular, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just concurring with you.
Yeah, like Cash keeps asking for Catherine, and everyone's like, no one here uses their real names and shit. And that doesn't really make sense for, like, I guess a club where you go to watch people dancing, but it would make a lot more sense for a strip club.
I mean, maybe this and, is just also, the beginning, and then later it turns into a, you know, more strippy.
Maybe. Well, there were all those naked ladies in the green room. Yeah. Also. Yeah.
And also, her act appears to be, she starts off dancing in front of a fan. Also, the act before her just for some reason involved having a motorcycle on the stage. Never explained. But anyway, so she comes out, she dances a little bit, she takes off her jacket, and then she asks the bartender for drums and drums for a while, and then rides around on the floor and then leaves, which it's just this bizarre act. You got to see this movie. I mean, not just for that reason, but that also does not hurt.
Yeah. Maybe it's like a Moulin Rouge style, like a little... racy, but not necessarily, but still classy. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think perhaps it was meant to to indicate to the audience the kind of barrenness and frankly confusing nature of heteroeroticism compared to the clarity and power of homoeroticism as depicted in the film.
Look, you try to sleep with a woman, it's all drumsticks and fans
and lolling around and, you know.
Oddly, then the next scene, Cash dresses up in drag and pretends to be in a lesbian relationship with Terry Hatcher to evade the cops, which, one, they put a real lot of effort into making him, it's really good drag, which is confusing.
It is.
Like,
yeah.
It's fishy drag, and he actually legitimately looks like a woman, basically. I mean, you know it's Kurt Russell, so you can spot the seams, but if you saw this person on a street, I think they would actually pass.
Yeah, and the shot that reveals him is this loving, slow pan from toe to head. Like, it is really, yeah, like, the camera is in love with him.
As are we all.
Yeah, it's one of these weird things, like, from, like, a scene from the 80s that has drag in it. You think they're going to make, like, some really mean-spirited, like, transphobic joke or something, and they really don't. Like, there is... I didn't really find that there was like anything in this that like was making fun of Kurt Russell for going in drag really at all.
No, it was pretty accepting. It was pretty.
Yeah, the only joke here is that he's so good at drag that a police officer thinks that he's a woman and tries to get them to have a three-way with him.
Yes, I had a note. I made sure I wrote that down because
like.
This police officer
with that guy.
This man shot his shot. So the way that the scene pans out is like this police officer's like looking, you know, Cash over. He's like, oh, hey, I want to get to know you a little better. And then, you know, he intimates that, like, actually, you know, I'm with her. And so he just baldly says, like, I think the literal line here is, any chance of a three-way? And I love the idea of propositioning that. I love the idea of propositioning that with any chance.
Can he take yours?
Right.
My favorite part. Oh, that whole drag scene was actually the misdirection that set it up, where Kurt Russell we're gonna sneak out because he saw the cops coming. He was like, "Do you have an Elvis costume? Do you have an Elvis costume?"
Elvis,
so you're thinking that he's gonna wear the Elvis costume, right?
It's just, Yeah.
Well, and then on top of that, they walk out and it's just the Elvis costume with the motorcycle helmet on. So you still don't know who it is. And you're like, right. Oh yeah, he's going to try to go incognito in the motorcycle helmet. They take it off and you're like, oh shit. It's like, no, it wasn't him.
This also ties into another weird thing where this movie is sort of as tolerant as it could be while still being this kind of movie. Cause like the cop, after they've said, no, we would not like to have a three-way with you, random stranger we met 5 seconds ago. He does say, well, you're just a bunch of lesbians. I think he might even say, like, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the D word or not, so I'm not going to.
Yeah.
He says the D word on bikes. But on the other hand, this character is represented as an absolute creep. So it's not like they're putting these sentiments into the mouth of a laudable guy.
Right. They're putting these sentiments into the mouth of the creepy loser.
Yeah.
And it's Kurt Russell who's, like, absolutely killing it. And pulling it off, and seems like he feels great.
Yeah. Kurt Russell in this never expresses like discomfort with. Yeah, the idea they never
play it with like he's like nervous or feels weird or bad or anything.
Yeah.
In fact, they go back to Terry Hatcher's apartment, and there's a little comic misunderstanding scene where like he had injured his back during escaping the prison. But he is also trying to get with her because he's very attracted to her. But like just sort of like. I love that we have this character who's like, he's just met this woman. he has been made up in drag by her. And he's still so chill about everything that he's absolutely putting the moves on her when they get back to her place. Like, he is not fazed at all.
He's got Riz that transcends sexuality.
It's incredible.
it's really something, man. It's just really, I don't know what else to say about it. I guess, does anyone else have high
points? I have
points?
One I mean, little high point. There's one little piece of dialogue that really got me. Okay, so Tango and Cash are arguing about like who's going to like say something at their trial. And they do it based on age. and Cash lies about it, and Tango's like, I read your file. I know when you were hatched.
That is a very rebel line.
That's good.
Okay, especially Kurt Russell. Like, these jokes, mostly terrible, but he kind of just sells them through sheer comic charisma. And even Sly makes a lot of this shit work. It's kind of uncanny.
Yeah, I was going to say, at this time, did Sylvester Stallone do any movies that were like intended to be funny? I don't know any.
Yeah,
soon after this one, he would do Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
And also that Oscar.
And also, Stallone was in Cop and a Half, right? That was Stallone.
No,
right?
That's Burt Reynolds.
That's Burt Reynolds. You're right.
That's
okay,
that's this horrible, that movie's, never mind.
That's plot material.
That movie features something that is, well, I don't know about that. That movie features something that is intended to be comic, but is actually just the sexual abuse of a child, which is very kind of hard to get past. Play a game called Swords, which I don't quite know what that implies, but it is something to do with like peeing and penises, and you should definitely not be playing it with a kid you are not related to.
Right.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know if Stallone had done comedic work prior to this, but he would have a few in the upcoming years.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, the chemistry here works so well that, like, I don't necessarily know that Stallone would be able to like really sell this that well on his own. Like a lot of jokes, but like the way that they play off of each other works really well.
Oh, I can't believe we forgot to mention Tango. Stallone's character is a millionaire investor who is a cop just for the adventure of it.
Yeah, sort of. He got margin called though, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was like, did he just lose all of his money? But then they don't mention it.
I just wanted to make sure that was on the record here on our podcast that it is like he's literally a wealthy adventurer.
Yeah, it's
just he's just brutalizing minorities for fun, man.
It's just for the thrill of it.
Anyways, Brandon, do you have any more high points?
I have a small one. So I think another scene that I really liked because it kind of blurred the line between being serious and being a parody is when they're torturing the head henchman guy that they capture on the roof. Or not really torturing him. They're trying to get information out of him, though. They hang him off the building and he's not scared. So they're like, all right, what's like plan B? So they strap him to a pole and they tie a grenade to his mouth. And they're like arguing about whether they're going to pull the pin. And it starts out, I feel, like Sly is actually being very convincing that he's angry and he's like gonna, you know, he's gonna go all over the edge because he's just like fed up with all of this. But as they continue to argue, it just gets less and less convincing. And they're just like still arguing like minutes, it feels like minutes later. Yeah. And then Cash kind of starts to walk away slowly and he keeps yelling back at him as he's leaving. And then Sly eventually goes and pulls a pin and it's just like, okay, that went from being like, you know, probably actually scary to be like, these guys are just fucking with me, but he got away with it. So,
yeah, it worked. That guy did tell them where the drugs were happening or whatever the fuck.
And then to top that off at the end, he's like, he said something about like, was he scared or I don't know. And he's like, well, he's standing in a puddle and it's not raining.
Yep, like, right. They psychologically brutalized this man until he peed himself.
Just with using a hand grenade as a ball gag.
This guy did deserve it though.
Yeah. Cuz he has the worst British accent. It was very sexual torture. Yeah. Well, also just that accent, man. It's unforgettable.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into low points cuz that's one of my.
Okay, let's transition to low points, I guess, unless there's anyone else. I mean, obviously the high point is just kind of the whole fucking movie.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Rules. But we can pick out some low points for sure.
Yeah.
I guess I'll go first, which is there's this very long action sequence where Tango and Cash are attacking the drug dealer's lair. And for some reason, they have an RV that is essentially being up, like, armored to be a tank with a Gatling gun on the side. And then the, like, people attacking them respond by deploying monster trucks, trucks that have mortars on the back, and also, like, just random construction equipment. And that sequence is pretty fucking boring, honestly. It goes on way too long.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to shoot action very well.
They're not really shooting. They're more like the bad guys are blowing themselves up and they're just rolling around town.
They're rolling through it. Yeah. And I'm glad that you mentioned the monster trucks, Lawrence, because I'm going to admit something. I was playing a computer game while I had the movie on. So, you know, I didn't actually Nerd have my eyes on screen the entire time. So the only time I saw monster trucks was there were a couple in the background of a shot of the construction equipment things messing the guys. And I thought I was going crazy for a second.
Is that a monster truck?
So I'm glad that it confirms that there were someone else saw the monster trucks.
Apparently they got the actual gravedigger monster truck for this.
Gravedigger.
Hell yeah.
Well, it honestly looked like it was
Sunday.
Sunday. It looked like it was filmed at like a Demolition Derby.
Yeah. Like the Monster Jam was in town, so they just kind of
went and filmed, which makes sense, but it's also sense. Like, because they're just like, driving around in dirt, pretty much.
They led with this compound being like an Air Force base that got decommissioned or whatever, and this guy bought it.
Yeah.
But there's been a lot of construction. But then when they get there, it just seems like a quarry or something.
I mean,
it's very
nothing there.
Yeah.
Classic action movie move.
Yeah. Well, I did enjoy the idea that this guy had like a fleet of trucks with machine guns and mortars and all this shit attached to it. And it's like, you can't, these are not street legal. As soon as you try this out, somebody's going to be like, why the fuck is there a truck with an M60 on the hood?
Like, yeah, my note for the scene was, why do they have technicals on site at the drug factory?
Yeah, right. It's like, well, that's clearly a criminal operation right there. Like, this is not even hidden.
Did TNC ever use their machine gun? Because I didn't see them use it.
Yeah, they must.
It was kind of blasting the whole time, and just as they kind of drove around, it strafed. Oh, shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to matter.
There was a lot where they didn't use it, and they didn't fire at any of the other vehicles, I don't think. But they did gun down a few guys with it.
Yep.
The other vehicles definitely were firing, too. I don't know. It wasn't a great scene, but I did appreciate how many different vehicles and, like, just the fact that they were driving all over the place. Like, I don't know.
Did it for you.
It was kind of fun.
I like how they hop into these two giant and I love construction equipment. All right. I want that on the record.
Yeah.
on the record.
They both hop into these gigantic, I don't even know. And then they like start plowing into the combat and then they run into each other. And that's the end of it. Wait, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah.
They're like, I guess
those things
these vehicles are OP. We can't continue the scene with them. We gotta finish them somehow.
I got another one, which is actually this might be a high point because this movie contains the greatest line of dialogue ever spoken in a movie, which is Tango. I haven't written down which one is which because it's hard to keep track for me otherwise. But Tango breaks into the house of a Fed. And just hangs out there. And the Fed goes into his, like, fridge to get a plate of spaghetti and meatballs out. And then he closes the door and Sly's standing next to him. And Sly says, and I quote, "By the look of your diet, it's obvious you're not too interested in counting calories. Could it be you're just too busy counting the money they paid you to set us up?" Yeah, what I love about that is its efficiency. There's not a wasted word there.
True. It's so elegant. I had a favorite line actually from that the Carmageddon sequence where Tango or so I don't know whoever the hell is, I forget which one is saying this, but there's a little exchange that I feel like someone missed it in the edits on the script. But you know, one of the guys says, "Where the hell did you learn to drive?" And the other one quips back, "Stevie Wonder."
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, no, that's the answer to the question, who taught you to drive? It's not the answer to the question. Like, at Stevie Wonder's house? Like, why would...
Stevie Wonder is the location, you idiot.
So it's clearly like they had an earlier joke there that it's was like, "Where the hell did you learn to drive?"
Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, and someone said whatever, or they had like a line where it was like, "Who taught you to drive?" And the answer was Stevie Wonder. But these two versions of the much like the conflicting versions of the flood story in Genesis, these two textual traditions were combined, but were not completely synopticized
over thousands of years.
Oh man.
Anyone else got something? I got more, but I don't want to.
I got like a low point that's also partially a question, because I also have to admit that towards the end, I wasn't paying as much attention. But then this happened and I was like, did they really just do that? So when they finally get in and they pull guns on the henchman and he has Sly's sister, Sly puts his gun down, but then Cash shows up and he's like, you know, trying to convince him to put his gun down, but Cash thinks he can get the headshot or whatever. Ultimately, he gives up and a different henchman takes his gun. And then I think I looked away for a moment. And then when I look back, they're like fighting hand to hand. So how did they get into hand to hand combat when like the drug people just took their guns?
I don't remember that. What I remember mostly is that for this scene, they've already killed Hong? What's goddamn it?
James Hong.
And Gul Dukat. They've already killed them. And so the final henchman is this weird fake British guy. But there's two there's a Tango and a Cash, and there's only one fake British guy. So they just introduce another character with the line, "You don't know me, mate, here, but he's been looking forward to kicking your head in." And then the other guy is corrupt. That's the only like introduction the like final henchman battle guy gets,
and he knows martial arts.
Kind they of show the that editing makes say. It hard to be sure.
Yeah,
but anyways, does anyone remember why they actually end up kung fu fighting? I think it just kind of happens. Honestly,
it just kind of happens. It's the same thing that it's the same thing that happens in. Did you guys ever see Matt LeBlanc's first stab at movie stardom after the success of Friends?
Is it the one where he's with an ape who plays baseball?
He is a professional baseball player who comes into the possession of a chimpanzee named Ed. So that's the name of the movie. So there's later on, of course, most of the escapades are about like, oh, kooky living with a chimpanzee and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And but at one point, Ed gets kidnapped by, I guess, whatever animal smugglers he escaped from.
I think, technically.
He gets ape-napped, thank you. Simeon snatched, as we call it in the biz. did not expect that big of a response from that one. I got Lawrence.
I don't know why. It just tickled me.
You're already becoming a dad, dude. It's already happening.
Terrifying.
So Ed gets kidnapped by the ape napped by these heavies, and so Matt LeBlanc, who at no point has shown any kind of, at no point has anyone had any kind of like fight or tumble or like he has exhibited any martial skills. He has a fight scene where he is just fucking kung fuing the shit out of these guys. And I was like 11 years old watching this and was like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, what? It was just so obvious that like, well, we have to have a scene where our hero like kicks the bad guy's butts. And it's like no setup for this at all. It was so
stupid. I gotta find that scene. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I've not seen it in 25 years or however the fuck old I am. So, you know.
What is this? Is this like an Any Which Way But Loose, but with Matt LeBlanc?
Yeah, it's Any Which Way.
He plays baseball.
Exactly. Yeah. See, if he was a bare knuckle fighter, that scene would make sense.
Yeah.
Does he at least use a baseball bat?
No, he's just like just pounding these guys. Yeah. There's no baseball. It's not even like he uses like, you know, I hope he makes like a, you know, like, oh, looks like you were caught sliding into home and then kicks the guy off a window or something. But I don't think anything baseball related. Like that would be funny, though, if he used like his baseball skills, like, you know, like a catcher's mitt or something. I don't fucking know. But anyway.
So you didn't like the fact that these guys, I mean, I guess it makes a little bit of sense that these hard apple cops would know kung fu, sort of, because that's the kind of thing hard apple cops.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the kind of world that these movies inhabit. You know, I'm more willing to give that a pass than I did for the monkey movie starring fucking Joey from Friends.
Ape movie, Dan.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Yeah. Anyways,
for someone who's as tied up in correct phylogeny when talking about extinct animals from 300 million years ago, you'd think yeah. I would have the grace.
I got another one. Unless someone else wants to chime in,
hit me.
So Jack Palance, it like there's this whole scene where like they're getting tortured in the basement of the prison or something. Very conveniently, the prison just kind of has torture vats and chains and shit. But anyway, so yeah. Jack Palance somehow contrives to get inside the prison to watch this happen. and he emerges from this steam that's in this room for some reason, and he's like this very ominous figure, and he steps out, and Tango and Cash look at him and realize instantly that this is the man who has architected their downfall, and they ask, "Who are you?" And he goes, "Just think of me as someone who doesn't like you very much." That's the line.
Yeah, you should, dude.
Also, really good Jack Palance hiss in your delivery there, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got one. We talked about it this a little bit earlier, but the British guy in this movie has like one of the worst British accents I've ever seen in a movie. It's like,
it's really
so
bad.
Atrocious.
There's one line where I think he says like, "Yeah, that's the bloke, that he's the governor."
Yeah,
like literally,
exactly. they just add in like random Britishisms, but he doesn't have the accent. He's like, "That's him, that's the governor," and it's like, that's not how that's used. No one says that. What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, who wrote this?
A Soviet guy, apparently. Okay,
yeah, fucking my hero wrote this. Thank you.
Oh, that's so good, but so terrible.
Yeah, I thought we were doing low points, but you guys have all been doing high points. So.
Yeah. I mean, that is right. The great strength of this movie, is that everything about it, even the bad stuff, is good. The action scenes do kind of suck, generally, aside from that one where they're, like, ziplining. But, whatever. Yeah. Surprisingly little action in this action movie, so it kind of doesn't matter that they're bad.
Yeah, there isn't that much. There's, like, maybe two fights and then the car chase scene.
Yeah. Anyways, I got. Anyone else got something? I got more. I could keep fucking going.
Well, I know you know you're bedtime Lawrence. I don't know. We don't want to keep you up longer than we
have
than
parting
we
shot.
Want to.
I have one, which is that at one point, Tango says, "I've never deliberately punched someone out. I'm very proud of that fact," which is just flatly untrue. We see him punch out like so many people before he says that. And why would he be proud of that anyways? We've also seen him murder multiple people. And he's like, "Okay, shooting a guy, fine. Punching someone else out, too far." What the fuck are you?
Yes, he definitely fired his gun at an approaching truck at the very introduction of the movie. So it's like, there's no way he did that. He missed on purpose. He was just aiming for the guy. And
it is kind of funny that they were being set up as being like two very different kinds of cop or whatever is supposed to be how it's supposed to be. But they're both extremely violent.
And yeah, like, I'm
constantly breaking the rules.
Like, legitimately, do they ever get any lead in the case without torturing someone?
No, this was straight up war on drugs propaganda, man. It was very gnarly.
I guess there's one where the chief just kind of says, "Hey guys, we need to move the plot along. Go here next." But aside from that, anytime they're investigating or interrogating someone, they resort to torture immediately, and it always works flawlessly. Which just that's not a good lesson. I mean, I know this movie is ridiculous and no one's looking to it for moral guidance, but that's still like not a great thing to have in your movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, I feel like this is one of the reasons where like it doesn't strike the parody note, because in a good parody, it would be making fun of the fact that they're doing torture for everything, and like for some reason it works. But like in this movie, they don't really acknowledge that, or like, I don't know. It's just, that's kind of standard action movie fare.
Yeah. That's true. The baked in fascism of the American action movie tradition is probably well worth exploring.
This is still straight up copaganda.
Yeah.
That's right. And we didn't fall for it. We were just delighted by it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We were just delighted by it and gave the people who made it money and would watch it again in a heartbeat.
Wait, does some of our, if we rent this movie, does some of the money go to that ex-Soviet director or whatever he was?
I would hope so. Possibly. Yeah.
I mean,
I watched it for free on Pluto.
Oh yeah, Pluto.
So I had to sit.
Thing I'd never.
I had to sit through some ads, and I hope my enduring being advertised for like foundation repair somehow a few red cents got into that guy's pocket.
I mean, bless him.
Based on this movie, based on this movie, he is one of the greatest filmmakers of his generation. So I really do hope he gets money.
Yeah. Kind of want to look up some of his other
stuff. His name? Mikhail Gorbachev. Only ex-Russian I can think of.
Ex-Russian? I mean, he's Soviet. Still Russian, dude.
I don't know. I don't know what to say for this.
Fair enough. None of us really
he's
do.
Still
we're
alive.
All,
Gorbachev is still
we're
alive.
All red dragons.
No, fucking Andrei Konchalovsky.
Konchalovsky, yeah. So he is ethnically Russian. He was born in Moscow.
Hell yeah.
That's what that means.
All right.
And he's still making movies. He's made a movie like 3 years
Holy
ago.
Holy shit.
That movie, Tangling Cash 2.
He made that insane Nutcracker 3D movie. That's one of his.
Wait, the one with all the Holocaust imagery?
I don't know if it has Holocaust imagery, but it has Nathan Lane and John Turturro in it.
Oh, man, I got to get to the bottom. Okay, Nutcracker
2010.
Holocaust.
Oh, that's a search. You know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. It has. Okay. The film was panned by critics upon its release. It was criticized for its story, deviations from the ballet, performances, twisted visuals, the decision to adapt Tchaikovsky's score into lyrical musical numbers, and allusions to World War II, Nazism, and the Holocaust.
Oh, man. He swung for the fences on this one.
That might be one we have to check out in the future.
I mean, the problem is that it's pretty hard to tell jokes about the Holocaust.
Where was this released? Was this released in America? Or?
Oh, this was, it was a...
It had John Turturro and Elle Fanning in it.
Yeah, I remember seeing, like, advertising for it.
Shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
This dude had a fucking movie starring Whoopi Goldberg and Jim Belushi come out the same year as Tango and Cash.
Wow.
Homer and
that was
Eddie.
Like Whoopi Goldberg's
heyday.
Oh,
he really
too.
Likes the names,
yeah.
The thing.
Yeah.
The two names, yeah. My brother's in art. We are going to have to dive deep into the filmography of this man. He fucking did an adaptation of Uncle Vanya, the Chekhov play.
Hell yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll do a script. Maybe. Well, he's got a little. Holy shit. Yeah, he had two come out in 2020. Apparently, Vladimir Putin saw his 2019 movie Sin. Anyways.
Huh. All right.
Yeah. Okay. I guess anyone else got like one last parting shot?
I got nothing.
That's sad.
I mean, there's so much left to say, but also, you know, is this the venue to say it? We should let the listener.
Yeah.
The
watch
listener go
this
and find
movie,
out for themselves.
Guys.
Yeah.
Watch this movie. Yeah.
If you take away what we have, I've got like literally 63 lines of notes, and we've covered maybe half of them. Go watch this movie.
Fuck me. Okay, I do have one last thing. Did you guys ever have to watch the Armand Desante version of The Odyssey when you were in school?
No.
Or did you ever see that when it came on?
I saw it. It came on TV, right?
Yeah, it was like a TV movie adaptation of The Odyssey starring.
Yeah.
That's this guy. He directed it.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. I would love to revisit that. Holy shit.
This guy, I mean, I joked. This guy has one of the most interesting and exciting filmographies of anyone like who's ever made movies.
It's really bizarre. Worth diving into, for sure. Holy moly.
Anyways, okay, I have a little bit of a game, actually. And this was kind of suggested by Rahul, but I'm going to put a little bit of a spin on it. So each of us, now we know how Jack Palance tried to take down Tango and Cash, but could you do any better? So let's go around and let's say what weird convoluted plan we would do to take out Tango and Cash. And then everyone else is going to critique it a little bit. Fair enough?
Sure.
All right.
Okay, so I'm going to go first because I've thought about this a little bit and you guys haven't. So this is going to proceed basically the way that the plan did up until they are going to prison. And when they go to prison, I'm not going to interfere and send them to an unpleasant prison. Instead, I'm going to have them go to Club Fed like they were supposed to. But I'm going to pull some strings behind the scenes so that they are assigned to each other's cells. So they become cellmates. And then I'm going to constantly kind of put like little like boxes of chocolates and flowers and stuff in there and play romantic music and a lot of candles and just do everything I can to encourage them to live up to what is obviously their destiny and fall in love with each other. And then after they get out of prison, they're going to be madly in love. They're going to move to Vermont. And they're going to manage a small bed and breakfast that's dog friendly, and they're not going to be LAPD cops anymore. And boom, problem solved.
That's right.
So wait. We're doing it from the perspective of being the drug lord? I thought we were trying to beat the drug lord.
No, that wasn't that interesting to me, because the solution to that is just shoot him.
The solution is that invade this...
Isn't that also the solution to this problem?
Well, apparently not, because it didn't work. Yeah. A lot of people tried to shoot Tango and Cash. That's true.
I think I got one, Lawrence, if you'll permit me. Okay. So, Jack Palance... He's there. He's with his rats. He's thinking, you know, what am I going to do with Tango and Cash? You know, he's
Cash and Tango.
Cash and Tango. Tango and Cash. The plan is he's going to get them to investigate each other.
Oh, shit.
He starts planting evidence like that. This one is the dirty cop on the inside who's helping the drug whatever, so that Cash is investigating Tango and Tango is investigating Cash. But not even Jack Palance can stand in the way of destiny. And in the course of their investigations of each other, they embrace their destiny and fall in love. And then they move to Lawrence's Vermont bed and breakfast. So we still get there, but I start out at a different place.
Gotcha.
The alternate pitch is that while they're investigating each other, they would just end up torturing one another to death, because that appears to be all they do when they investigate.
And that also awakens something inside them, and they happen to go to... There was a... in the small town in Indiana where my mom's family is from, and I consider my hometown, there was a bed and breakfast that was actually operated as a BDSM torture dungeon.
Hell yeah.
Wow.
So that might be the route they decide to take after they find out they really get really spun up with torturing each other.
Hey guys, check this out. A B and BDSM.
Uh-huh.
Come on. It's okay. It's good.
I like it.
Anyways, Brandon, do you have a pitch on how you're going to take down Tango and Cash?
Yeah, I have a great pitch. So I'm going to take all that useless land that Palance has, and I'm going to build a human-sized maze. And at the sting or the setup, instead of having them arrested, we're just going to capture them, and then we're going to put them in the maze. And it's just going to take them like a month to get out of it.
That's right. It's a literal maze.
Yeah.
Well, that would have made a just lot like more sense.
I don't think that they would be very good at getting out of the maze. They seem to be kind of idiots.
Especially since obviously they would fall in love with each other, you know, while they're in the maze.
And also, they just don't leave anyone in there for them to torture, and they'd get no information.
Yeah, they wouldn't know how to get out because they couldn't beat the route out of
this
someone.
This seems pretty foolproof.
They would just start torturing each other for information about how to get out.
Yeah. Win-win.
Rahul, do you got one?
All right. Yeah, if I was Jack, you know what I would do? This is what I would do. I would start just getting monster shipments of products from wherever. You know, just let Tango and Cash bust as much as they can. You know, they would ascend the ranks. They'd become like, they'd be like national heroes for like every week. They just like bust like thousands and thousands of tons of cocaine. But you're just making so much money that you just, on the volume, it doesn't matter, right? It's just like shoplifting, and you're a grocery store. So you just ignore them.
You know,
just accept the losses.
There is a newspaper. Okay, also, for some reason, the newspapers in this world, they always have Tango and Cash news on the front page.
Yes. Always.
The trial of Tango and Cash, who are, of course, household names, was like multiple like weeks of like front page news. But anyway,
that is, of course, the last shot of the movie is the headline, Tango and Cash, heroes again.
But anyways, at one point it does say that Tango seized $1 billion in drugs and Cash seized 400 kilograms of cocaine. And I'm just throwing this out there. I don't think there is any drug operation on Earth that can absorb $1 billion in losses.
Yeah. You gotta hang up your hat. Yeah.
I've looked into it, and apparently $1 billion of cocaine, assuming he just did cocaine and not something else, is 40,000 pounds.
That's one semi truck. Yeah, you know, I'm just saying you ordered two semi trucks.
20 tons. My God.
Yeah. Anyways, Ronald, how are you going to defeat Tango and Cash?
Okay. If I'm Parrot, all right, I'm thinking, and it's like clearly throw my henchmen at it, it's not going to work. I'm thinking that the problem is more systemic. Okay, so I'm taking a political route here. We start, you know, riding on the back of Perestroika. We're gonna get some policies enabled. We're gonna go for some kind of similar type of glasnost in the United States, where we have more transparency in the government, and we start to defund the cops because, you know, that's really more of like a fascist kind of thing. And eventually, you know, I bribe enough city councilors and state senators that the police department is in shambles. They have no funding anymore, and Tango and Cash are basically out of a job.
I mean, you could also just try to make it like so that they enforce the anti-torture laws, and Tango and Cash become powerless.
they have no
skills. Well, that's part of it. I mean, that's all. That's, you know, this is that's all part of their steep slope downwards. They can't torture anymore.
That's
all
right.
Their cases are going to get thrown out because there's going to be more transparency in how they actually did their investigation. And yeah, and honestly, probably Tango would quit long before he got fired because it wouldn't be fun anymore, because he wouldn't just be able to torture people for fun, as he stated as his motivation for doing the job.
Yep. Okay, so Perrette, if you're listening, there's 5 different pitches on how you could defeat Tango and Cash that I think would work better than what you did.
That no, also, which is very confusing. Yeah, assembling your monster truck army and waiting for them.
drive in and kill you all.
And here's a bonus 6th one. Listen to Gul Dukat and just shoot them. Because I think that would actually work.
That solves a lot of their problems in a very elegant way.
Yeah,
they definitely could have done it in the prison, and they just chose not to.
Yeah, that said they went for torture, and it took too long and didn't work.
Yeah, it's the curse of being a bad guy. Exactly, because you can never just
Do it. It doesn't work for bad guys. It only works for good guys.
Yeah.
You know, that actually, come to think of it, he tortured them, and it did nothing for him too. You're right.
No, it did something.
Yep.
Oh, right. But, I mean, not anything that really helped him with his crimes.
I mean, it didn't give him any business help.
Didn't know what you might help. Yeah.
Anyways, let's go ahead and do some recommendations and cautions. What do you guys think?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Brandon, would you like to go first?
Sure. So I have one recommendation, which is a movie called Manhunter. It's the first film adaptation of the Red Dragon book, and it was I mostly watched it because I heard that Brian Cox was really good in it, and I think he was really good in it. He's kind of like a predictably small part of it, because I mean I already know what Red Dragon's about, but also the main villain, who is Tom Noonan, I don't really know anything else he's been in, but he was really good. I mean, it's basically just the same story as the remake, but I'm trying to think if anything else like really stood out about it. I'm just like so flooded with Tango and Cash stuff right now, but I think it was really good, and I just really enjoyed Brian Cox. It's like a different take on Hannibal Lecter. Instead of, he's like a lot less crazy, and he was more like kind of charismatic almost, but in a like creepy way. And then the other guy playing Francis was really good. So yeah, you should check it out.
I will watch that. It sounds great.
Yeah, I'll second that. It's a very cool movie.
I'll third it. It's Michael Mann directing, and it's got a lot of like really interesting process on how the FBI actually tracks him down that the Silence of the Lamb and later Manhunter movies kind of like gloss over. That's like really fascinating to watch.
Okay.
Anyways,
it's a Michael Mann movie that came out before Silence of the Lambs about Hannibal.
Yeah, it's really weird because everyone's kind of forgotten that it exists, but it is like really fucking good.
Shit, I love Michael Mann. All right, I'm definitely putting it on my
list. Yeah, it's also got really great like Michael Mann. I don't know if it's Tangerine Dream doing it, but it sure does sound like them.
Yeah.
Score. Anyways, Dan, would you like to go next?
Yeah, I'll have a recommendation. The video game I was playing while watching Tango and Cash is the 2015 or 16 masterpiece XCOM 2.
Hell yeah.
So if y'all are into turn-based tactical level strategy, it is probably the finest example of that kind of game I have ever played. I have replayed it dozens and dozens of times. I've beaten it twice on Iron Man. Wow. It's one of my favorite game experiences. Thank you. It's one of my favorite game experiences of all time. It took a lot of you have to restart until you don't fuck up too bad in the first few missions. It's typically so you can find it in, you know, any of your, you know, computer game distributors like GOG Galaxy or Steam, and it went around a little bit because it goes on sale a lot, so you can pick it up for like less than $10 typically. But yeah, just a really awesome game, really high quality, and it looks even better and more amazing and runs like smooth, silky butter with that a computer components that Lawrence graciously let me have.
Ah. Yeah.
But and no cautions. I'm embracing positivity today.
Nice. Tango and Cash would want us to embrace positivity and police brutality in equal measure. Anyways, I'm going to go next. So my recommendation is a 2022, I think. Let me check that. I should have before. It's a movie called Scare Me, directed by Josh Rubin and starring him, Aya Cash, and Chris Redd. Oh, it's 2020. And the basic premise is that a guy, he's like going through some stuff. So he goes and rents a cabin and he really wants to become a writer. So he's like, I'm going to rent this cabin. I'm going to write like a screenplay, a story, whatever the fuck. And then at the end of the weekend, I will be a writer and that's going to solve my life. And then it turns out that in the cabin next to him is a very successful horror authoress or whatever, played by Aya Cash. And so their power goes out and they're hanging out and shooting the shit. And she's a little bit humoring him and a little bit being a jerk to him about him being a writer. And so they start telling each other scary stories and kind of acting them out. So it's this really weird like actor showcase, but not like actor showcase where they're doing subtlety and restraint, but instead like actor showcase of like what's the weirdest like physicality you can embody or the funniest face you can pull or the weirdest voice you can do. There is a little bit of like serious acting, but a lot of it is just like Josh Rubin pretending to be a troll or something, which is very fun to watch. And it's pretty funny. It tries a little bit to take a turn into suspense at the end that doesn't work. Also, Chris Redd shows up 2/3 of the way through and it's just a fucking delight. I love that guy. Anyways, you know, check it out. It's on Shudder. It's a very good, like, it's weird because it's like, it's people telling each other scary stories. It's not particularly scary. So I guess it's like technically maybe a horror comedy, but it is basically just a comedy that at the very end tries to make you feel suspenseful for a little bit and fails. But still, check that shit out. Yeah. And then for my caution, for God knows what reason, I watched a movie called The Goods, Live Fast, Sell Hard, about a like hired gun. Yeah. Are you familiar with this film, Dan?
No, I love that title. Go, continue.
Yeah. It's about a hired gun used car salesman who will like get, he and his team get brought, or car salesman, who get brought into like lots of failing cars to like just do weird sales and like unscrupulous shit and like empty the
lot out.
Is that
a Jeremy Piven movie?
Yes. And it wants,
I feel like I saw the trailer for this back in the day.
Yeah, it wants so badly to be Anchorman. It's got a murderer's row of like fucking David Koechner, Catherine Hahn, that guy, like the buster from Arrested Development.
Tony Hale.
Yeah, Tony Hale. Who's the like Asian actor who's in all of the Judd Apatow movies?
Ken Jeong.
Yeah, it's got Ken Jeong. It's got just all these fucking actors. It's got a cameo by Will Ferrell. It's produced by Adam McKay. But the problem is that in the fucking lead role, you've got Jeremy Piven, and that guy just it's like he's trying to be Ron Burgundy of Used Car Salesman, which means he needs like this, that weird, like absolute strange charisma that Will Ferrell has, and he just does not have it. And also, there's a bunch of jokes where, God damn, why am I spacing on his name? Coast Guard guy, Rob Riggle. For some reason, Rob Riggle is playing a 10-year-old with a glandular disorder, and Catherine Hahn falls in love with him and instantly starts trying to fuck him. And everyone else is like, that's a 10-year-old, stop it. But she just keeps trying, and this is supposed to be hilarious. But it's just like, guys, stop doing pedophile jokes. I know that it's a weird pedophile joke, but it's still, man. Yeah, it's just okay. When Catherine Hahn isn't trying to rape a kid, she's pretty funny in it. And Ving Rhames is funny. And then there's also a kind of funny bit where Phil Robinson, right? Is that a guy?
I'm sure it's someone.
Yeah, no, the guy from The Office. God damn it. Daryl from
Craig
The Office.
Craig Robinson.
God damn it. Craig Robinson. Why am I so bad with names when I keep wanting to name names? Craig Robinson actually is incredibly funny as a DJ who has decided that if he ever takes a request from anybody, that will diminish his self-respect and mean that no one will ever look up to him again. But so that's pretty good, but everything else sucks, basically. So do not watch The Goods, Live Fast, Sell Hard, unless you can, like, use machine learning to replace Jeremy Piven with someone better. And that's it. That's it. Okay, Rahul, I don't think you've recommended anything, right?
Okay, this is the rare moments when I have a recommendation. Have you heard of The Black Adder? I've been watching that lately. And
the seminal British comedy series.
Yeah, I'm a little late it, but it's amazing. Freaking hilarious. Yeah, Rowan Atkinson, Hugh Laurie in the third season is so good. It is a little insensitive, to be expected. Yeah.
It's from like the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Ancient. It's freaking hilarious. Like British comedy, I don't know, it's very Monty Python-y British comedy. It's just so good. I love it.
Have you gotten up to the last series where they're in World War One?
The last season of it?
Yeah.
No, I'm only on season 3.
It famously has a very strange ending, and I was kind of curious what you thought of it.
Oh, cool. Oh, well. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, in 5 fucking months when you get to it.
No, look, he's gonna stop now that
you spoiled it.
Anyways, do you have a caution?
No caution.
Okay, and Ronald, I don't believe you've gone.
I'll be quick because I know we're trying to get out of here tonight. Okay, I got a recommendation and I got a caution. Recommendation, this is a classic, you've probably all seen it, 12 Angry Men from 1957, directed by Sidney Lumet, starring Henry Fonda. This movie's free on YouTube right now. I've watched it. It's probably like my at least 6th watch of this movie. I love this. I love the play too. But it's such a good one. It's just like, it's so timeless, even though it's from, Jesus, almost 70 years ago, that it's like, it still like works really well. It doesn't really feel aged at all. 12 Angry Men, excellent movie. Check it out if you haven't seen it, but I think probably most people have seen that one. So
I haven't. This. So this is that's a cool tip that it's for free on YouTube. I'm definitely going to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like 90 minutes. It's a really easy watch. It's really interesting and just a great movie. My caution, I saw this in theaters, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, 2023, directed by James Mangold, starring Harrison Ford. This movie sucks. This is like, you know how they say, like, the worst art is the art that, like, makes you feel nothing? That's what this movie is. It's, like, competent, but it's not interesting in, like, it doesn't do anything daring. Like, there's nothing in this that I even really remember very well because it's just, like, so bland. it's like a fine time if you have it on in the background and you're like watching and it's on TV. But I would not go to the movie theaters for this movie. I was incredibly bored. That's why I went. I was choosing between this and Transformers. I went to this. I think I probably should have gone with
what?
Transformers.
What about it?
I think
was
that had
nope,
a better
you
chance.
Shouldn't have. Transformers also fucking sucked.
Why? No. Why was Dawn of Destiny boring?
Because it just doesn't do anything interesting.
It's just like, all been done before.
Is you've seen stale? The if you've seen the other Indiana Jones, there's nothing that this adds to the series. If you haven't seen the other Indiana Jones, you're just going to be like, why is this movie so nostalgic for like the movies I haven't ever seen?
Gotcha.
Like this is like the classic, like, oh, this is the sequel to an old series. They don't do anything interesting. They worship the old movies. They don't try to take any new direction. This one does, this is maybe a slight spoiler, but this one does kind of famously have this like weird thing where they travel through time. But they do nothing with it. They do like nothing interesting with it. And the movie kind of ends with being like, well, I guess that happened and I don't know why. And, you know, it's kind of like the other Indiana Jones where they like see something and it's like crazy. And then they're like, well, we're going to just pack that one away and never talk about it again.
Crystal Skull.
And the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail and basically all of them. That's fine. That's fine. And it's fine in the old movies because it's like, this is like kind of it's like a B movie action. Like that's what they're going for in those. And so the cultiness works there. I think where this movie doesn't work is that it reveres the old one so much that it's acting like this is like this huge deal, like that Indiana Jones is back. And so instead of being like fun and campy, it's just like, I don't know. It's competent action without anything interesting to say. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the kind of the same deal they had with that Ghostbusters sequel. What was it? Ghostbusters Afterlife? Where it was just like reverential. And it's like, why are you going to take a reverential tone in a Ghostbusters movie? People like it because it's silly and there's monsters.
Right, exactly. I feel like it's probably like, I think I saw that movie, but I don't really remember it at all. I don't know if I really watched it. It was on while I was on my phone or something. But it's probably a very similar kind of deal to that, where it's just like, it literally has nothing interesting to say. And it comes from these movies where they like, the new 2015 or whatever Ghostbusters movie that came out that was like really panned by fans because it wasn't reverential, I guess. Maybe these people are think like audiences want to see, but they're wrong because this was just a completely boring movie. Don't go see Indiana Jones.
You know, the more I think about it, like, I don't think Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is a good movie, but at least aside from that thing at the ending where Indy gets married, it is mostly just trying to be an Indiana Jones movie that, like, does new shit, you know?
I would have rather watched the Crystal Skull than this one. I think that it's very similar to, like, how I feel about the new Star Wars versus, like, the prequel Star Wars, where, like, the prequel Star Wars are, like, bad, but they're really weird and like something interesting is happening in them. Even if like part of that interesting is like, how the fuck did this get funded? Like the new Star Wars are just like, this was made by a committee.
Yeah,
and completely
the soulless aspect of it.
They're like, we're giving you Star Wars for the night. Please take it out for a little drive maybe, but please don't put more than 100 miles on the odometer and do not scratch the
paint. Make sure there's a laser.
And here's the exact route. It's the same route that we followed in the other movies. Like, yeah, that's what happened in the new Star Wars. And that's this isn't quite as bad where it's like, this is the exact same movie as the old Indiana Jones movies, but it's like close enough. Like it's still Nazis. It's still like, I don't know, Harrison Ford being kind of curmudgeon-y and trying to get stuff put in museums. And I don't know. Whatever, just don't bother with this one. It's just not worth really talking anymore about.
It's too bad.
Oh, yeah. Did I miss anyone? I'm sorry. My memory is not working as good as I might like.
No, Brandon.
No, I did Manhunter.
I was listening.
Okay. Okay. So, finally, Rahul, do you have a plug?
Oh, God.
So, I saw a video, which was amazing. Man, you may have seen this. This is in Atlanta. Man enters salon brandishing gun. He's like, give me the money, give me the money. Have you seen this? And
I haven't watched it. I saw it come by my
so feed. Good. Yeah. Give me the money, give me the money. And the guy at the cash register, the phone rings, he answers it, hello. there are all these people sitting there, they stay seated. He's like, give me the money.
They just ignore him?
They just ignore him. He sort of walks around. He's like, cashier just walks away.
He's got imposter syndrome as a robber.
He just leaves. I guess nothing.
They don't even bother calling the cops because they're like, technically, yeah.
I'm going to post in the Zencaster, or I'll put in the Discord chat.
Nobody even bothers calling the cops because technically in the South it's not a crime to just brandish a gun in a place.
I was gonna say we in the South do not have time for this shit, so move along.
It's too damn hot. Yeah,
we got to think of new ways of disenfranchising Black people. We do not have time to give you money.
We're very busy.
It's so good.
This is from CBS News, and the headline is "Man tries to rob Atlanta nail salon but gets ignored." Video shows.
Oh man!
Devastating. Yep. That guy got owned almost as much as Ronald when I made him watch this movie.
This guy got owned so hard. Anyway, that's my plug. I guess I'm plugging CBS.
And from all of us at Bad Time Radio, don't worship Satan. It's bad for you. And one sec, I'll never forget that time in the shower, which is the thing that Kurt Russell says in Dangle with Cat.
Perfect.
Bye, everybody.
If you'd like to recommend an episode of Old Time Radio for us to listen to, send us a question for the mailbag, or a pedantic correction, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is Finger in the Bottle by We Ashore Dedicated off their album No Ski Here Okie Sap. Thanks so much for listening.
Well, I was gonna gather it.